This audio file is a production of the University of Chicago Law School. Visit us on the web at www.law.uchicago.edu.
Hi, I'm told that we're supposed to introduce ourselves, but I'm not going to do that because I think it'd be more interesting to have to sit here and listen to somebody talk when you don't know who it is. So what I want to talk about this afternoon is the Supreme Court. And although this is billed as the Obama Supreme Court, that's actually false advertising. I want to talk more about the current Supreme Court and whether or not Obama would have any opportunity meaningfully to change it and what that would mean. But mostly I want to focus on the current court itself. I want to begin with a pet peeve of mine, which is that in the public conception, there is a general understanding that because the Supreme Court frequently divides 5-4 on the most contentious issues, that implies that the Supreme Court is balanced. And most people who are not law students and who hear about all these 5-4 decisions assume that that reflects some notion of a reasonable balance within the court. But of course, that's extremely misleading. Virtually any group of 9 justices on the Supreme Court, whether they be 9 Antonin Scalias or 9 Thurgood Marshalls, over time would wind up dividing 5-4 in most cases. And the reason for that, of course, is that the Supreme Court has discretionary jurisdiction. It therefore chooses the cases that are the most difficult and the most contentious, where there's the least clarity in the lower courts. And over time, the cases that will meet that description will be the cases that divide any particular group of 9 justices. And so the fact that a court divides 5-4 on the most difficult cases tells you really nothing of interest. What really matters is where on some spectrum the midpoint of the court actually is. And the fact that they divide 5-4 does not suggest at all that they're in the middle of some spectrum. But they could be all the way on the left end or all the way on the right end, and any given group of justices will divide that way over time, inevitably, given the nature of the court's jurisdiction. So it's important to understand that in the first instance, because, of course, it's often the case today that the court is divided 5-4 on contentious issues, and that does not suggest at all a balanced court in any way that has any content to it. Second thing I want to talk about is the makeup of the current Supreme Court and how one should think about the current court on that spectrum of ideological or legal or jurisprudential perspectives. This is, I want to assert, an exceedingly conservative Supreme Court, indeed the most conservative court in the memory of any living person. And that this can be demonstrated, not that it's really contentious, but this can be demonstrated in many reasonably persuasive ways. 7 of the 9 current justices were appointed by Republican presidents. 12 of the last 14 nominees were by Republican presidents. And that itself is a proxy. You should give a pretty good idea of what the makeup of the court is likely to be. Of course, the fact that 7 of the 9 justices and 12 of the last 14 nominees were made by Republican presidents is in part the product of the fact that Republicans have won more presidential elections in the recent past, and therefore this may be simply the reflection of the larger political makeup of the country. But it's also the fact that some of the timing of retirements and resignations and deaths, which have, by coincidence, exaggerated the partisan effect on appointments. But the fact remains, if I were to tell you simply that 7 of the 9 justices on the Supreme Court were appointed by Republicans, you would probably draw the inference quite sensibly that it's therefore likely to be a much more conservative than liberal court. But there's a lot better evidence than that, or confirming evidence, I suggest. So, for example, over the past 40 years, the swing justice, the fifth vote in the most interesting and controversial and contentious decisions, has shifted over those 40 years from Justice Powell, from Justice Stewart to Justice Powell to Justice O'Connor to Justice Kennedy. And anyone who knows anything about those justices would understand that's a straight march to the right. Relative to Justice Kennedy, each of those justices was more liberal, and that goes back in precisely that order as one goes back in time. Indeed, the thought that a nominee of Ronald Reagan would be the swing vote in the Supreme Court would be quite stunning to people in the United States at the time, for example, that Kennedy was appointed, because he was regarded as an extreme conservative. And that he would suddenly now be the swing justice would have been quite surprising 20-some years ago. Another fact which Justice Stevens pointed out, which is quite accurate and interesting, is that every justice appointed to the Supreme Court since Stevens in 1975 has made the court more conservative than the justice whom he or she replaced. So that if you look at the pairings, departing justice, new justice, for every nominee, every appointment since Stevens, which is now 35 years ago, was more conservative than the justice that he or she replaced. Which again shows this very dramatic shift to the right. The two other points worth noting about this is that four of the current justices, by any reasonable judgment, are more conservative than any other justice who has served on the Supreme Court in the last 75 years, with the possible exception of Rehnquist. But Scalia, Thomas, Roberts, and Alito, and Dick Posner, by the way, demonstrated this in a piece he wrote recently evaluating the ideology of justices, that Scalia, Thomas, Roberts, and Alito are more conservative than any justice, except possibly Rehnquist, who would be in the middle of that group, that served on the Supreme Court in the last 75 years. At the same time, there is no liberal justice on the current Supreme Court. That is, if by liberal one means William Brennan or Thurgood Marshall or Earl Warren or William Douglas, none of the justices currently identified as liberals is remotely a liberal in terms of their positions on constitutional law relative to, say, real liberal justices. And indeed, that shouldn't be surprising. Two of the four liberals were appointed by Republican presidents, and indeed both of them adamantly deny that they're liberals. Justice Stevens pointed out that when he was appointed, he was in the center of the court, and now he's off on the left wing, and he says, well, I haven't changed, the court's changed. Now, that's not quite true. I think Stevens has, in fact, evolved over the years he's been on the court, but the basic point remains accurate. That Stevens has changed a whole lot less than the court as a whole has changed during that period of time. But certainly even those appointed by Democratic presidents, by Clinton, Ginsburg, and Breyer, are relative to the justices I just identified as liberal, are in fact quite moderate in comparison. So basically we have a court with four justices who are exceedingly conservative, more conservative than anyone else who served on the Supreme Court in 75 years, except possibly Rehnquist. One justice appointed by Reagan, who's very conservative, but is the swing justice. And then four justices who were basically moderate to moderate liberal, but who were perceived as liberals because they're on the left side of this particular group of nine justices. Okay, so I've been throwing around the words liberal and conservative pretty loosely. And obviously I need to explain what I mean by those terms, because they're not always self-defining. Basically, what I mean by liberal and conservative in this respect is when a justice chooses to exercise the power of judicial review. That is, when a justice chooses to be a judicial activist and when a judge chooses to be a judicial pacifist. And that activism and pacifism can be seen as a useful measure of what I mean, at least, by liberal and conservative. Now, it should be clear, and I want to emphasize this, that activist is not the same thing as liberal, and pacifist is not the same thing as conservative. That's an important misunderstanding. An activist justice, for example, could be a justice who, in the Lochner era, held regulations of minimum wages and maximum hours and child labor unconstitutional in an activist way, on the premise that this progressive legislation, politically liberal legislation, violated their conceptions of the Constitution. Or a justice could believe that racial segregation in public schools violates the Equal Protection Clause, which could be seen as an activist liberal interpretation of the Constitution. But activism is not, despite the public misunderstanding, necessarily correlated with liberalism any more than it is necessarily correlated with conservatism. So it's more nuanced than that. The critical question is, when does one choose to be an activist? So what do I mean by a liberal? Well, I mentioned four justices a moment ago who fit within my understanding of a sort of paradigm liberal justice, so Warren, Brennan, Marshall, and Douglas. And what characterized their jurisprudence was a use of judicial activism, a use of the power of judicial review to invalidate laws adopted by the democratically elected branches of government, but not across the boards. They were not judicial activists in everything. They picked and chose those particular areas where they felt it was appropriate to be activist, and picked many other areas where they chose to be quite pacifist. So the interesting question for them, since they all served at least in part of their careers on their Warren Court, is to go back and look at their jurisprudence and forget about anything they may have said or anybody may have said about them, and simply look at their behavior as justices and say, well, when did they exercise aggressive judicial activism? When were they muscular in their decision to hold acts of the democratic elected branches of government unconstitutional? And what can one infer from that set of decisions? Well, what one discovers if one looks at the corpus of decisions generally identified with those justices is that they exercise judicial review in an activist way, primarily, almost exclusively, but primarily, certainly, in two types of situations. First, where a minority was at risk of being treated unsympathetically or being oppressed by an intolerant or possibly prejudiced majority. And examples of that would be, for instance, Brown versus the Board of Education, or the school prayer decision, or the rights of women, or the rights of individuals accused of crime, or political dissidents. It was circumstances in which they felt that the ordinary processes of majoritarian decision making would likely break down, and that you would have a systematic lack of respect for the interests of a particular minority or dissident group. And the second set of cases that you can identify with these justices are those where they felt that the pathways for political change had become blocked by entrenched or aspiring entrenched majorities. So cases like the reapportionment decisions, or the Pentagon Papers case, or much of their free speech cases about dissenters again, fits within this other notion that a danger in the majoritarian process of democracy is that a transient majority can take control, make the rules to perpetuate themselves in power, and then block the effective functioning of a democratic system. And that both of these areas where the liberal justices were aggressive in their assertion of judicial review were areas in which they believed, and indeed the framers of the Constitution believed, judicial review was especially important. That is, the particular importance of an independent judiciary was to place a check on majorities who were running rampant. And the particular areas that that was true in are those where you have a systematic majority being insensitive to the interests and rights of an entrenched minority, and where you have efforts of the majority to undermine the democratic process by manipulating that process in ways that perpetuate themselves in power. If you go back and look at Warren Court decisions, what you'll find is virtually every decision that the Warren Court makes that exercises very activist judicial review fits in these two categories. And so it was, I would argue, a coherent use of judicial power rooted in an understanding of the potential deficiencies of democratic governance, and that were rooted in deficiencies that the framers themselves identified in their own concerns about the Constitution and about how to protect against these types of abuses of majoritarianism. So that's what I mean by a liberal justice. And they don't use judicial review actively in most other situations. They tend to be deferential to the legislature in most other situations where those two problems aren't presented. Okay, conservative turns out to be more complicated. As I see it, there are at least three variants of conservatism that have to be separately identified. The first of these is the judicial passivist. That is, a judicial passivist is a justice who basically takes the view that we live in a democratic society where the majority should be able to make decisions. Judicial review is anti-majoritarian, and judges therefore should give every benefit of the doubt in all circumstances to the acts of the democratically elected branch of the government. And that unless, to put the point simply, unless a law is invalid beyond a reasonable doubt, period, then the court should essentially defer. Now, this was the version of conservatism that was most trumpeted at the time of the Warren Court and at the time that Richard Nixon called for a change in the direction of the court and nominated people like Rehnquist, Berger, Blackmun, and Powell to the Supreme Court. That is, the debate at that time was between judicial activism, as represented by the Warren Court, by Brennan, Marshall, Douglas, and Warren, and judicial passivism, as represented by Berger, Powell, Blackmun, and Rehnquist. And the basic idea was that they were passivists. They were like Felix Frankfurter. Their view of the role of the justice was very deferential to the legislature. It didn't matter what constitutional provision was involved. It didn't matter whether you had issues involved like discrete and insular minorities, or whether you had issues like blockages in the political system. The basic approach across the board was to be deferential. And in the debates about the Warren Court, that was the way in which the debate was framed. And conservative judges were understood as passivist judges. Now, judicial passivism is a perfectly principled approach. It is neutral. Sometimes it will lead to liberal results. Sometimes it will lead to politically conservative results. It just depends on what law is being challenged. It's not inherently liberal or conservative. It's just passivist. And it became associated with conservatism only because it arose most recently in the background of the Warren Court. If you go back a couple of generations before that, at the end of the Lochner era, the idea of judicial passivism was politically liberal. It was a response to the activist conservatism of the Supreme Court of the prior generation, which had used judicial power in a muscular way to invalidate progressive legislation. And so activism and passivism themselves neutral. Well, passivism is neutral with respect to political outcomes. It just depends on what law is at issue. So it's a principled approach. It's a neutral approach. The question arises, however, is it a good approach? And I would argue it's not a good approach. It's a bad approach. And indeed, it's one of the reasons why none of the justices appointed by Nixon actually adhere to it, and why no current Supreme Court justice can be described as, in any way, shape, or form, as a judicial pacifist. Although it has the virtues of neutrality, it also has the evil of abdication. And so it assumes, basically, that the courts don't have an important role. But that abdicates what was, in fact, a very different understanding about the role of courts and the necessity of courts, which was, in fact, to play a significant role in invalidating legislation because, in fact, democratic elected majorities can sometimes behave badly. And so the reason pacifism has never really been a dominant view in the Supreme Court, and the reason why it's never, certainly in the last 50 years, been seriously championed by any justice is because I think all of them recognize, first of all, it would be no fun to be a justice in a world of pacifism, because then you just say everything's okay. But beyond that, it's actually an irresponsible approach. It would be as if Congress said, okay, the best way not to do anything bad is not to act, so we're just not going to pass any laws. But that fails to meet a whole set of responsibilities that Congress has. And the same thing is true of the Supreme Court. Okay, so pacifism is a principled approach, it's a neutral approach, it reflects the views of none of the current justices remotely, and in my view, it's not a good approach, even though it's sort of simple, because it gives up responsibility as well as power. Okay, the second form of conservatism is what's become known as originalism. And pretty much everybody is an originalist, taken at its broadest sense. That is, virtually no one really argues that the text and the intent of the framers are irrelevant to interpreting the Constitution. The question really turns on how rigidly bound one feels one is by the text or the intent of the framers. And what I mean by originalism is the assumption that, to put it in its simplest form, that nothing should be held unconstitutional that the framers of any particular provision didn't intend to hold unconstitutional. So basically, the role of the justice is to implement the intent of the framers. It's not to expand upon that intent, it's not to contract from that intent, it's simply to act upon it in a simple, straightforward way. Now, the advantage of originalism, understood in that way, is that it has the virtue of both activism and pacifism. That is, as I just described it, it essentially makes the justices neutral historians. They aren't making policy judgments. They aren't making judgments about meaning that are complicated from a jurisprudential standpoint. They're basically seeking the right answer, and they believe there is a right answer, and what their job is to simply execute the right answer. So a law is constitutional if the framers intended it to be so, and it's unconstitutional if they intended it to be so. Even with that version of originalism, there'll be some complicated questions. So for example, you know, is wiretapping a search within the meaning of the Fourth Amendment? Well, obviously the framers didn't intend that because they didn't know about telephones or wiretapping. So an originalist may have to struggle a little bit with analogies and so on, but they try to keep the analogies reasonably closely tied to what they believed to have been originally prohibited. So originalism, viewed the way I just described it, is a principled approach, and it's a neutral approach. It doesn't necessarily correlate with liberal or conservative outcomes, but it also has serious deficiencies. The first deficiency is that it's very hard to know what the framers intended. For the most part, they didn't. For the most part, when they wrote things like Congress shall make the law abridging the freedom of speech or of the press, or no person shall be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, they didn't really have any concrete understanding in mind. They'd never lived in a constitutional universe before. They didn't debate the details of the meaning of any of those provisions. They didn't have much of an idea themselves at all what those provisions meant. They were adopting aspirations, and they knew they were adopting aspirations. They were saying these are important things and they should be respected and they must be respected, but they weren't adopting a code of specific detailed outcomes that they had in mind. There were some areas in which they had a pretty clear understanding of what they believed, but most others they didn't. And so the first problem with originalism is it assumes a state of the world that doesn't actually exist. It assumes that all we have to do is open up the history book and we'll find the answer to our questions. But the truth is we don't. When we go back and look at that and ask, well, did the framers intend to prohibit seditious libel? We don't even know that. The truth is they didn't think about the question that way. They thought about adopting aspirations. And therefore, originalism itself, if it's meant to be, we're going to find right answers, is based on an assumption that simply, unfortunately, perhaps, isn't methodologically doable. You don't get right answers when you go back and look at the history. You don't get answers at all most of the time. That isn't to say there aren't occasional answers, but they're very few and far between. So the question then is, what happens when a judge says, I'm going to be an originalist, and I'm going to go back and I'm going to only enforce the constitutional provision to the extent the framers intended to enforce it, no more, no less? Well, what typically happens is this. They go back and they look, and they don't actually find a whole lot that gives them clear answers on any questions. And so they ask themselves, well, okay, what would the framers have intended if they had thought about the question? And they say, well, the framers were reasonable people, reasonable men. I'm a reasonable person. So they would have intended what I would have intended. So lo and behold, those people who employ originalism almost invariably find that the original intent happens to comport with their views of a good constitution. Now, there are very occasional exceptions to that, where a justice applying originalism will actually come up with an outcome that would seem not compatible with their general preferences as a justice, but it's very rare. Almost invariably, and this is true for liberal as well as conservative justices, because originalism is not necessarily liberal or conservative, will almost invariably come up with whatever answer they want. And what that suggests is it's not, in fact, a very helpful methodology. Because what it really does is just project the judge's preferences back to the framers, and then they get the answer they were looking for to begin with. The other problem with originalism is it's completely non-originalist. That is, the framers of these provisions did not intend that these provisions would be understood in this way. If they did, they would have been much more careful about trying to figure out what they intended and saying it. But the fact is they didn't have this conception of interpretation, at least in this narrow sense of originalism. They understood they were adopting aspirations and vague concepts, equal protection of the laws, due process of law, unreasonable searches and seizures, establishment of religion, cruel and unusual punishment. They didn't have fixed meanings. They were just values. And they expected full well that those values, these were men of the Enlightenment, that they believed in the progress of knowledge. They believed people would learn with experience and that these terms would evolve in appropriate ways depending upon how knowledge changed and how experience changed and how society changed. And so that isn't to say they meant them to be totally open-ended invitations for judges to run amok, but it did mean that they were adopting something called free speech without knowing what it was and without knowing how that applies to campaign finance reform or how that applies to draft card burning, and didn't intend to fix any definition there. Okay, so originalism is fine in theory but impossible in practice and in any event internally inconsistent. It purports to be originalist, but it bases itself on a methodology that the framers themselves would never have ascribed to. The third form of conservatism, which is by far the dominant, I should say Scalia and Thomas are the two current justices who occasionally invoke originalism within the current Supreme Court. The third form of conservatism, which is the dominant form of conservatism on the current Supreme Court, and which is employed consistently by Roberts, Alito, Scalia, Thomas, and often by Kennedy, is what I'll call conservative activism, the flip side of liberal activism. What's important to note is conservative activism is not about judicial restraint. It's not about judicial pacifism. It's not about originalism. It's like judicial activism in the sense that it selects certain aspects of the Constitution to enforce aggressively and selects many other aspects of the Constitution to enforce passively. And I stated before that you could infer from the results reached by judicial activists, by Warren, Brennan, Marshall, and Douglas, what was motivating their judicial activism. And it seems to me the right way to figure out what motivates your conservative activism is to look at the results and to say, well, okay, where is the current majority of the Supreme Court being activist, and what do we learn from that? So if you look across constitutional law today and Supreme Court decisions in the last 10, 15 years, what you find is that the Supreme Court majority and what I've called the conservative majority in particular basically is activist in the following areas. One could add to this list, but these are the most commonly identified ones. They hold unconstitutional laws regulating and restricting commercial advertising. They're pretty aggressive about that. They hold unconstitutional laws regulating what corporations and wealthy individuals can spend on their favorite political candidates. They hold unconstitutional affirmative action. They hold unconstitutional gun control. And they hold unconstitutional laws that regulate property. Other than that, and they hold unconstitutional federal laws. Indeed, they've held unconstitutional more federal laws than almost the entire history of the Supreme Court up until the last 15 years. That's basically the corpus of judicial activism for conservative justices. And it represents about the same percentage of the court's docket as the Warren Court's activist decisions represented in their era. So what do you get from that set of cases? As I said, you could extrapolate a theory from the judicial activists in the liberal era that explains the decisions. Well, what do you get here? Well, it doesn't seem to me you get anything. I don't see any theory of judicial review or of the role of courts, appropriate role of courts, that explains that collection of issues. They don't really seem to have anything very much in common other than the fact, quite bluntly, that they're consistent with political conservatism. And that's, in my view, highly problematic. So let me give you two examples, because I think it's really the phenomenon of conservative activism is really pretty extreme. And I want to just give you two illustrations of what I mean by that. The first of these involves Bush versus Gore, in which the court, of course, held unconstitutional the decision of the Florida Supreme Court calling for a recount in the 2000 presidential election. And in the decision, Justices Scalia and Thomas voted to hold that the Florida Supreme Court process violated the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. I actually happen to think that's a perfectly plausible argument, by the way. And indeed, if I were on the court, I might even have adopted that approach. So it's not that there's anything wrong with the approach. What's wrong with it, as you'll see, is the selectivity with which Scalia and Thomas chose to embrace it. So Scalia and Thomas had cast votes 46 times in cases involving the application of the Equal Protection Clause before the decision in Bush versus Gore that did not involve affirmative action. We'll come back to affirmative action later. In those 46 votes, they voted only two times to hold the challenge law unconstitutional under the Equal Protection Clause. That's 4%, roughly. The other justices on the Supreme Court in those same cases, including conservative justices as well as liberal justices, voted 74% of the time to invalidate those challenge laws under the Equal Protection Clause. Now, what were those cases? Well, there were cases brought by African Americans, by Hispanics, by women, by gays, by people who were disabled, challenging a whole slew of different types of laws that were discriminatory towards them. And Scalia and Thomas basically took the view that the Equal Protection Clause doesn't really have any relevance to any of those cases. They took what I guess one could call as a highly selective passivist approach. Selective in the sense that it was about the Equal Protection Clause when the plaintiffs were black or Hispanic or women or gay or disabled or similar categories. In Bush v. Gore, however, Scalia and Thomas suddenly discover the wonders of the Equal Protection Clause and invalidate the law on a basis that they refused to accept, even though 74% of their colleagues accepted it, in a whole range of other cases, much more obviously and directly tied to equal protection issues than the issue in Bush v. Gore. Now, I put aside the affirmative action cases. Scalia and Thomas, before Bush v. Gore, had cast votes 19 times in affirmative action cases. All 19 of their votes, 100%, were voted to hold the challenged laws unconstitutional on the ground that they discriminated, the affirmative action programs discriminated against whites. Their colleagues voted 55% of the time to hold the affirmative action programs constitutional, whereas they voted 0% of the time to hold affirmative action constitutional. So basically, what one can say for Thomas and Scalia is that the Equal Protection Clause means that affirmative action is unconstitutional and that George Bush gets to be president. And beyond that, it essentially has no meaning. That's a pretty striking understanding of the Constitution. And it reveals a lot about what they think the clause means or applies. Now, they were not aware of this voting pattern. And what's interesting about it is that you elicit this after the fact. And if you confronted them with this, with the assertion that they only think the Equal Protection Clause is useful in two situations, when the law tries to benefit African Americans and when George Bush might be caused to presidency, they would say, that's ridiculous. I don't mean that. I don't believe that. But then you go and look at their votes, and that's exactly the message that you wind up with. Okay, the second example I'll give, which I happen to be aware of for other research reasons, is Chief Justice Rehnquist on the First Amendment, free speech, free press part of the First Amendment. During his 30-plus years on the Supreme Court, Rehnquist decided 260 cases, voted in 260 cases, in which there was a non-unanimous decision. I'm eliminating the unanimous cases because they're obviously easy and uninteresting. 260 non-unanimous cases involving the free speech or free press clause. In those cases, Rehnquist voted 8% of the time to uphold the assertion of free speech or free press. 92% of the time, he voted to reject the challenge to a law on the claim that it violated the First Amendment. His colleagues in those same cases voted 56% of the time. Again, this includes even Scalia and Thomas. His colleagues voted 56% of the time to invalidate laws when they were challenged on free speech or free press grounds. So 8% versus 56%, seven times more often. The other justices voted to invalidate laws about speech and press than Rehnquist. And this covers a broad array of cases involving all sorts of things from political dissidents on the one hand to handing out leaflets on the other, to obscenity, to sexually oriented speech that's not obscene, and the like. Now, there's still the 8%. So what's interesting then is, well, what were the 8% in which Rehnquist voted to invalidate laws? Well, it turns out they all fall into four categories, every single one. The only times, other than unanimous opinions, when Rehnquist in 30-plus years voted to invalidate a law under free speech or free press fall into these four categories. Commercial advertising. Laws regulating commercial advertising were frequently held by Rehnquist to be unconstitutional. Laws regulating corporate expenditures in the political process were held by Rehnquist to be unconstitutional. Laws regulating religious speech were held pretty consistently by Rehnquist to be unconstitutional. And Rehnquist voted to hold the policy of the Boy Scouts to exclude gays and lesbians to be constitutionally protected and therefore held on invalid a state anti-discrimination law as a violation of the First Amendment rights of the Boy Scouts to exclude gays and lesbians from their ranks. That's it in 30 plus years. Now again, that is simply a result, revelation, of what he thinks the First Amendment means. It doesn't protect the freedom of the press. It doesn't protect the freedom of political dissenters. It doesn't protect the freedom of individuals to have a robust opportunity to express their views. It only protects commercial advertising, corporate expenditures, religious speech, and the Boy Scouts. I submit that's perverse. And the problem with the current Supreme Court, in my view, is that they are employing the power of judicial review quite actively, not passively at all, quite actively, but in service of results that don't make any sense from a standpoint of constitutional theory or judicial power. They are simply political results implemented through the judicial process without any principled explanation for why these cases should be the ones where the court chooses to use its authority rather than others. So this finally brings me to Obama. Clearly, when he has the opportunity to appoint justices to the Supreme Court, Obama will appoint individuals who incline more towards the liberal than conservative view of these matters. I don't think there's any doubt about that. There is a doubt, and a quite legitimate one, I think, about whether Obama will appoint justices like Ginsburg and Breyer rather than like Brennan and Marshall. And my guess is he's much more likely, in fact, to appoint moderate liberals rather than liberals, because it's not clear he's willing to take on the fight that would be involved in trying to appoint someone who was seen as more traditionally liberal. But in any event, it is highly unlikely that even if he serves two terms, that Obama will have any impact on the current distribution of views in the Supreme Court. That is, the justices most likely to step down in the next 4 to 8 years are Stephen, Souter, and Ginsburg. It is highly unlikely, barring unforeseen illness or death, that Scalia, Thomas, Roberts, Alito, or Kennedy will step down in the next 4 to 8 years. What that means is it is likely true that 8 years from now, we will still have the same 5-member majority in the Supreme Court we have today. That what Obama will have done is to replace some moderate liberals with other moderate liberals, so they'll be around longer. But the substantive distribution of rhetoric and debate in the court will not change significantly. And by the way, the reason I think it's unfortunate that he won't appoint, or I think he's unlikely to appoint, more committed liberal voices, the reason I think that's unfortunate is because what you hear in debate obviously affects the tenor of what views are thought respectable, what views are thought weighty. And if no one within the Supreme Court is advocating for a strong liberal position, then that is likely to undermine the moderate liberals and wind up moving the court more towards the sort of conservative majority. So Obama will have opportunities, but it's not at all clear, indeed it's unlikely in my view, that it'll have any impact on the current majority of the court, even if he serves 8 years as president. And as you can probably figure out from what I've said, I don't think that's a good thing for the court or a good thing for the country. So thank you, and I'm happy to take questions. So right, the question is, do I think his executive branch nominees portend anything positive for the judicial nominees, because he has picked some people who are understood to be more liberal? I think it's different because the political response you get to executive branch nominees is much more tepid than judicial ones, because they serve for only the time you're the president. They don't serve for life, so the stakes are less high, and there's more of a sense that a president should have the ability to bring around him the people who he wants, and that therefore the primary objection to them should be on grounds of competence or ethics, not on grounds of ideology or point of view, whereas with judges, there's much more of a sense that the Senate should play a more independent role and have its own voice in lifetime nominees. So I think for that reason, one can expect greater opposition to judicial appointments, particularly on the Supreme Court, than one would see for executive branch nominees. And the other complicating issue is that I think it's probably the case, for quite understandable reasons, that in the public understanding, that the progressive voice has lost over the last 25 years the comprehension of the public. So what's happened is the public tends to think that conservative nominees apply the Constitution the way it's written, and they don't make it up out of whole cloth as they go along. And they are therefore responsibly interpreting and applying the Constitution, whereas liberal justices are wild-eyed crazies who are rewriting the Constitution from scratch as they see fit. And this very effective political campaign that to shape public opinion about the judiciary over the past 25 or so years has really worked. And that I think most people in the public tend to think that justices like Roberts and Alito apply the Constitution as it's written, and if you were to nominate someone like a Thurgood Marshall or William Brennan, most people in the public would easily accept the criticism that this is somebody who's going to simply make it up as he goes along. So I think that from in terms of political challenge to appoint justices like that, you're setting yourself up for a more difficult public challenge. The public doesn't care about executive branch nominees. The other point about that that's tricky is that liberal activists, and indeed any activist really, is anti-majoritarian. So if you're going to say, I want to appoint this person because he will tell you what you can't do, right? That's not a very politically savvy or effective way of nominating somebody, right? What you really are saying is, I want to appoint a justice that's going to prevent you, the majority, from doing what you want because I don't trust you, because we don't trust you, because the Constitution doesn't trust you. And so what the conservative presidents have managed to do since Reagan, and even since Nixon, is to basically treat their nominees as pacifists who let the majority do what they want, even though they don't, in fact. But they've managed to create this impression that what they are is pacifists when they're not. Whereas I think Obama would much more directly face the problem of how do you explain to people that I want a justice who will exercise the power to tell you what you can't do. And that's a harder debate to win. So I think those are the reasons why he's likely to be more cautious. And I don't approve of this, but I think that's a prediction.
Yeah, just building off of your the perception of just the liberal way of thinking about courts, do you think that that's really affected since, like, let's say the 80s, the deep bench? Like, when you hear the nominees on the short list, they're really, you don't even hear people speculating about a potential Brennan or a potential Marshall. And do you think it's because, like, all the top Supreme Court advocates are now playing in the box that Scalia, Rehnquist, and Thomas did, and they're just not using the creative thoughts to make Brennan and Marshall types judgments, and they lock themselves in?
That's a good question. I mean, the question is, you know, where are the people who would be the Brennan Marshalls and so on? And there's a couple of problems there. One problem is that Obama will have to appoint justices, who have not been on the bench, or he will have to appoint fairly old ones, because it's now been 8 years since. 9 years since Clinton appointed anybody, the last of his nominees, and that presents a problem where you draw your nominees from, because it's become much more common in recent years to appoint sitting Court of Appeals judges. There's no necessary reason for that, but it's become very much the norm. Those sitting judges who might otherwise be available for Obama are likely to be getting up in years for your ideal Supreme Court nominee, say the age of Roberts or Alito. And Bush had the advantage, in a funny, perverse sense, of not having any nominees to the court for several years, so he was able to appoint people to the Court of Appeals and then promote them to the Supreme Court, which is what he did with Roberts and Alito. Obama will have that also by the time he's been in office for 3 or 4 years, but it's likely that 2 or 3 of his appointments are going to happen too quickly for that. So that's one point. The second point is, which is the larger one, is where is the current generation of people who are like Brennan's and Marshall's, whether they're in academia or on the bench or whatever? And because the Supreme Court has moved so far to the right over the past 40 years since Nixon, academics who are writing about constitutional law have tended to write against what the law is, about what the law is. And therefore, if you're doing constitutional law, either as an advocate or as an academic, which are the two other most likely career paths to get you to the Supreme Court, you're basically dealing with a body of law that is far removed from anything Brennan Marshall would have ever created. And therefore, there's no reason to think very much about that, except in the sort of counter-universe idea. But if you're taking law seriously at all, the whole agenda gets shifted to wherever the court is, right? So in the generation that went to law school, as I did, during the Warren Court, constitutional law was about the Warren Court. And therefore, anybody writing about it, even conservatives, were writing about that universe. And that moved everybody to the left. And now, since everything's been shifted so far to the right, very few people are actually trying to imagine a world as it would have appeared if, for example, the Warren Court had continued over the last 40 years. So people don't even really know what it would mean today to be that kind of a justice. And people haven't had occasion to write about that, because except for those few, and particularly people who are under 50, who didn't really grow up in the Warren Court era at all, it all seems to pass, this is history, it's for legal historians, not for lawyers. So part of the challenge there is that you don't have people who've actually lived in that counter universe, and it's why Breyer and Ginsburg are both fairly moderate liberal justices, I think. And even now it'll be harder. So it's actually an interesting problem for Obama. If I were asked to identify people who were in the right age cohort and who I believed would be the next generation of Marshall and Brennan, I'd actually have a very hard time identifying people like that, because it's not that they don't exist, it's just that they haven't written anything that would tell you that they exist, because it would seem off the wall. Other questions? Okay, thank you very much.
This audio file is a production of the University of Chicago Law School. Visit us on the web at www.law.uchicago.edu.